Hello, this is Albert Einstein. History myths fly around at the speed of light. Especially with that new internet thing you all seem to have. Thank goodness I have a direct connection to Professor Buzzkill, a fellow deep thinker who busts myths and takes names. I'm totally stoked. There's a new episode. I was stuck on this new equation anyway. E equals MC something. Something. Nah.
Now that the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing has passed, and almost everything that can be said about it has been said, we here at the Buzzkill Institute can safely address some of the myths and misconceptions about the history of the American space program and not worry about our shows being buried by all the media celebration of that historic event. President John Kennedy gets all the credit usually for the political will to shoot for the moon, for committing the government to funding it, and for inspiring the American public to get behind the program. But as always, history is more complicated than that. Fortunately, we have political historian and writer Jeff Sechel on the line, whose recent New Yorker article enlightened me about the fuller story of the American space program and about Lyndon Johnson's central role in creating it. Thanks a lot for being on the show. Your New Yorker article was extremely eye-opening to me. Like most Americans, I thought, you know, the moon program, the lunar program, everything was all JFK's idea. But of course, you have shown very clearly that it was LBJ's.
Well, it was LBJ's and a good number of other folks, but yeah. In terms of that White House, that administration, it was really Lyndon Johnson more than anyone who drove the decision to go to the moon.
Well, I think the key thing too, which was so amazing, was that he started his involvement early on. When did this start for LBJ?
Remarkably, it started almost literally the moment that Americans heard that the Soviets had succeeded in sending a satellite into space.
Oh.
Sputnik went up October 4th, 1957, and literally within hours, Lyndon Johnson was working the phones trying to figure out not only what to do about it, but also how he might politically benefit from it. So that effort was underway right away.
Do we have any sense of why, I mean, apart from the maybe personal political motivation, LBJ might have been interested in space? Did he have a sort of scientific bone in his body?
I wouldn't say that bone was ever located. I don't think Johnson okay. I don't think Johnson had any particular interest in science. He had never indicated that during his years in the Senate. I mean, he covered a lot of different issues during those years, but I don't think anyone would say that this was a particular passion of his or a particular interest of his. I think he saw a number of things. Johnson, of course, had one of the most acute political antennas in American political life. And there was something that Johnson recognized right away in understanding that the Soviets had sent this satellite up and hearing something of the panic that was beginning to develop right away when the news reached the United States. And that is that this was the future. There had been a lot of talk for a number of years in the popular press about space and about going to the moon and exploring the stars and so forth. Wernher von Braun, the German rocket engineer who had been brought to the United States after World War II, had done a great deal to popularize the idea of space exploration beginning early in the 1950s. So this was very much in the air, but here the Soviets had actually done it. They'd actually sent a satellite into orbit. It was going over the United States. People saw it as it passed over, or they believed that they saw it. Either way, it was terrifying. And Johnson saw that this was the future, and he wanted to be the guy who represented the future. He also saw that there was a political opportunity here, not just in being that guy, but also in seizing an issue that had a great deal of symbolic power. There had been a lot of concern on the part of Democrats during the 1950s in a reversal of how we understand the political breakdown to be in more recent era. But the Democrats felt that it was actually the Republican administration under President Eisenhower that was weak on defense, that was cutting defense budgets and or at least not expanding them to the degree that the Democrats would have liked to see. And there was a general sense that in the country, and certainly strongly in the Democratic Party, that the country was adrift, that the Eisenhower administration was not nearly as aggressive in defending the nation and building up a stockpile of conventional and nuclear weapons as it ought to have been. And so the idea that the Soviets could attach one of these things, the satellite, to a powerful rocket and put it up into orbit was very close to the technology, as most people understood it, that it would take to send a nuclear missile
right.
as far as that, into space or into the United States.
Well, then what was the... When LBJ starts to push for this right after Sputnik, how was it received by the rest of Congress and the Eisenhower administration? Were the Democrats right when, as you say in your article, all the rockets, all the American attempts later on to go, a lot of them anyway, were kept failing and failing, and this was sort of a stick to beat the Republicans with in the upcoming election? But if he starts talking about the moon in 57, 58, 59, are people looking at him like he's crazy?
Well, Johnson's not really talking about the moon publicly at that point.
Okay.
He's really talking more about getting a satellite into orbit and catching up with the Soviet Union, surpassing the Soviet Union. But you're absolutely right. While Wernher von Braun and others talked about sending men to the moon, and you saw it in comic books and weird science and other comic books and kind of pulp magazines like that, serious politicians were not talking about going to the moon at that point. I mean, particularly at a time when we had not done what the Soviets had done and had not sent even, I mean, Sputnik was essentially a little silver ball with some antennas sticking out of it, and it was incredible to anyone that they had managed to do that. So it seemed to be some time down the line before anybody was going to send a human being into space, let alone all the way to the moon. But Johnson did see that this was the direction that the conversation was going. And we were talking about politics a few minutes ago. It was not merely that this was an opportunity to score some points against the Republicans, but it was also an opportunity for Johnson to change the subject for the Democrats. What was ripping apart the Democratic Party at that point was civil rights. And Johnson, while he was tentatively stepping forward to try to lead that in a positive direction, he also would have been perfectly happy not to have this grabbing the headlines. And so this seemed like a positive program, space exploration, that the Democrats could rally around and talk about, and not be endlessly mired in talk of segregation.
And because there's, of course, big division within the Democratic Party over Northern Democrats, Southern Democrats, et cetera.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, so we've got LBJ with his idea and with pushing for it for all kinds of reasons, but where was JFK during all this late 50s work? Do we know what his thoughts were about a space program? Or this early? I know the famous stuff later in the early 60s, all the speeches and everything, but what was he thinking in the late 50s?
He's not thinking much about space at all, really, in the late 1950s. On a certain level, all Americans were thinking about Sputnik. It was commanding a lot of attention, generating a lot of panic across the country, and just about everybody had something to say about it. And Kennedy certainly made a couple of public references to it, but he wasn't particularly focused on it, and he wasn't particularly interested at the time in developing a response to it. He was far more interested in defense issues, and some time passed before Kennedy really connected in the way that Johnson did immediately, really connected defense issues with space exploration.
Because like you say, when Kennedy back then referred to Soviet satellites, he was talking about the countries of Eastern Europe, not about actual Sputniks flying around the globe.
Yes, absolutely. He was very focused on foreign affairs. Generally, he had been throughout his life. That had been a focus of his family's, of course, growing up in the Kennedy family, with his father, who had served as ambassador to Great Britain during the war. And so this was a focus of his, and while you might see early on some intersection between space issues and foreign affairs, really, I think Kennedy felt at the time that there were larger concerns. and the Soviet domination of Eastern Europe was certainly a far greater concern, and Soviet and communist encroachment in other parts of the globe was a far greater concern. And space to him seemed a bit of a distraction. At the time, the head of MIT's instrumentation lab, right, a guy named Charles Stark Draper, had actually approached John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy not long after Sputnik had gone up in late 57, and they had dinner at a restaurant in Boston, and Draper was hoping to draw the Kennedys into this effort.
Obviously, JFK is still a senator at this point. Yeah,
exactly. JFK is a senator, and Robert Kennedy is at this point a Senate staffer and really very much an instrument of his brothers at this point, an advisor of his brothers. And so he took them out to dinner and tried to convince them to help him commit the nation to this goal of space exploration. And they kind of gave him a hard time. They mocked him in a kind of good-natured way, but they were just unable at that point to be convinced that this was not just a big waste of money. Huh. And they were interested in missiles, they were interested in rockets, but they were not particularly interested in sending satellites, let alone men, up on the top of those rockets. It really was not until you get closer to 1960 that Kennedy, and this is after a couple of years of this and other Soviet space accomplishments,
right,
and a kind of ongoing building concern in the country that the Soviets are not just performing these spectacular feats in space, but they're building towards something most likely terrifying. For example, and this was the kind of thing that you were reading about in the press at the time or hearing from politicians, maybe the Soviets wanted to build a floating, an orbiting nuclear platform that would just sit essentially in space above the United States, or circle around a few times a day and have the ability to rain missiles down on the United States. Maybe they wanted to build a nuclear base on the moon.
Yeah.
As ludicrous as that sounds, I mean, they had nuclear bases on the Earth.
Right.
This was new and sounded absolutely terrifying. But it really was not until you get closer to 1959, 1960 that John Kennedy really starts fully to appreciate the symbolic power of space and starts to conflate, as so many Americans do, the space race and the missile race, or as he talked about it in 1960, the space gap and the missile gap.
Oh, okay. Now, do they use it? Did Kennedy and Johnson use it against Nixon in the election of 1960? Or do other issues, you know, swamp the agenda? Do they use the space program as a cudgel, as you say in your article, to beat the Republicans?
Well, to be clear, you're absolutely right. This was not an election about space, fundamentally.
Right, okay.
There was a lot of talk about space on the campaign trail, but again, it was space as a symbolic issue. Kennedy,
gotcha.
The crux of Kennedy's attack on the Republicans, on the Eisenhower administration, which of course Kennedy's opponent, Richard Nixon, had been part of. He was vice president. Mm-hmm. To Richard Nixon, I'm sorry, to Dwight Eisenhower. I'm jumping ahead in political history here. The crux of Kennedy's attack on the Eisenhower administration, the Eisenhower-Nixon administration, as he began right. to call it, was that it was enervated. It lacked vigor. It lacked resolve. It lacked a force of will in the face of the mounting communist challenge around the globe. And mm-hmm. you could look at the weakness, as he portrayed it, of the American nuclear arsenal as one indication of that. You could look at what was believed to be the missile gap between the United States and the Soviet Union to the Soviet advantage as another indication. And you could look at the fact that with repeated success, the Soviets were managing to send not only rockets and not only satellites, but by this point, satellites carrying living things, carrying plants and bugs, but most spectacularly, dogs into space.
That's right.
And it was understood that they had no interest in sending dogs into space. The interest was in sending human beings into space, and that they were taking really significant steps toward making that possible. And so Kennedy talked a fair bit about space in 1960, again, not because he was so interested in space particularly, but because it seemed to him to capture a failure, to describe a failure on the part of the Republican administration.
So what happens then when a man goes up, when the Soviet cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin goes up? Is this the thing that focuses JFK and presumably LBJ?
Yes, and nothing focused the mind like the fact of Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space, not only making it to space and making it back, but also orbiting around the Earth. And that made Sputnik seem like pretty small potatoes. Mm-hmm. And there had been some hope by 1961 when that happened, April 12, 1961. There had been some hope, although I wouldn't say great confidence, that the United States was on the verge of catching up to the Soviets, and that it was conceivable that even though we fell behind from the get-go in terms of space spectaculars, as they were repeatedly called in the press, mm-hmm. that we might in fact beat them to space. And we had initiated our own astronaut program, the first, mm-hmm. Beginning in early 1959, Project Mercury.
Right.
With the obvious ambition of sending men into space and bringing them back and orbiting the Earth. These astronauts by early 1961 were very, very well known to the American public. Everyone had really followed the program and through its various tribulations. There were a lot of, as you indicated earlier, there were rockets that exploded on the launch pad. There were rockets that went up 4 feet in the air above the launch pad before exploding. There were others that went up a little higher than that and arced and then exploded over the ocean and sent whatever payload they were carrying, thankfully not a human payload, tumbling into the Atlantic Ocean off of Cape Canaveral. So there had been a lot of interest in this, but there was a feeling by the time that Kennedy got into office at the beginning of 1961 that the program was picking up steam. There was some momentum. There was the likelihood that we would get someone into space soon, even if we didn't necessarily beat the Soviets. There was a pretty good shot at that. And then all of a sudden, they had done it. It was, as I said,
you mean April, Gagarin had gone up.
Yes, Gagarin had gone up. And even though it was anticipated, it was a shock to the system. It was a shock to the system as profound or more profound than Sputnik. And this was what finally sent Kennedy into really a bit of a panic in the White House that something had to be done about this. He had spent the first few months of his administration being consumed with a lot of other pressing matters. And as I indicated when talking about Kennedy in the 1950s, he never really thought that space was the most pressing concern. And it would be hard to argue, frankly, that it was. And so he was caught up in dealing with all sorts of matters between the United States and the Soviet Union and other issues in other parts of the world, as well as domestic concerns, economic concerns, and so forth. And so while he had the intention of doing something about space and doing something different about space and putting together a plan that allowed the United States to not only catch up to the Soviets, but ultimately get ahead of the Soviets at some point, he just hadn't gotten around to it. And then all of a sudden, the Soviets had this incredible success, and there was no time. He had to come up with a plan. He had to come up with a plan right away. And it was Lyndon Johnson who naturally stepped forward to be the one to do that.
Okay, that seems to me to be the key, both in the development of the program, but also the key in your article, where you argue that effectively in the same month that Gagarin goes up, LBJ then sends a memo to JFK suggesting the manned lunar mission.
That's right. Johnson had been working on this all along. Kennedy uh-huh. had been occupied, as I said, with all sorts of other matters, but Johnson was trying to make the space program very much his own. Kennedy's lack of interest was an opportunity for Johnson on a certain level, and that Kennedy essentially delegated space to Johnson and said, "You figure it out." He named Johnson the head of the Space Council, which was an office within the White House that was supposed to be coordinating space policy and working with the Defense Department, working with NASA and so forth. And so that was very much Johnson's baby. He staffed it. He helped to figure out who was going to run NASA under the new administration. And he was lining up supporters for this idea that the United States needed to make some very bold, very aggressive moves into space. And he was very interested by this point in going to the moon. even though, again, the United States had not yet put a human being in space, mm-hmm. the idea of getting to the moon was real now in a way that it had not been in 1957 or 1958. And the technology was starting to move in a direction where it was more conceivable. Von Braun and others were advocating this very strongly. And Johnson believed that actually the moon mm-hmm. offered the United States an opportunity to leapfrog the Soviets. It was clear that if you looked at existing technology and Soviet rockets versus U.S. rockets, that they were going to beat us to all the nearby milestones. They just had more rocket power than the United States. It was ironic in a way because their rockets were a lot less sophisticated than American sure. rockets. We had smaller, more efficient missiles. But actually, the downside of that was that you couldn't put as much stuff on the top of that missile and send that stuff up into orbit. You needed a big brute of a missile to do that. And the United States had tended to work those out of the stockpile over the course of the last decade or so. So the lack of technological sophistication in the missile realm actually worked to the Soviets' advantage. But Johnson saw that we were not going to catch them in the near distance. But if you look to the long-term goals, something like going to the moon, which was going to involve huge steps and technologies that built on things that had been done already, but really hadn't been developed or even fully conceived yet, that if you set a goal that was that far down the line, that it just might offer the opportunity, if you're focused on that, to, as I said, leapfrog the Soviets toward the really big goal, to essentially almost cede the near-term goals in favor of the long-term one.
Yeah, leapfrog is seems to be absolutely the perfect term to describe this, but I can imagine that it would have been difficult for LBJ to win the argument and convince the rest of Kennedy's cabinet to take up the lunar idea. In other words, there might be a number of cabinet officials who say, no, this is crazy, they'll die up there or whatever, or no, we need to build up to the nearer goals, as you say, and then maybe go to the moon. The moon leapfrogging seems to be almost...
Well, and they did. Some You're politicians absolutely right, the particularly the budget director, David Bell, and a good number of others felt that this was a colossal waste of money for something mm-hmm. that hadn't really established its worth. Why did we need to catch up to the Soviets? Why did we need to get ahead of the Soviets in space? Why did we need to go to the moon? There were a lot of rationales bumping around out there. Maybe it had something to do with military, as I mentioned before. Maybe the Soviets had military designs on space, and we just needed to get up there so we didn't cede the territory to them. Maybe there was some scientific reason to do it, although the scientific community was actually pretty divided about that. Yeah, they were interested in what mm-hmm. was going on in space. Yes, they were interested in what we might discover if we're actually able to get human observers and better equipment up there. But they also were pretty interested in things that were going on Earth that we hadn't figured out. And they understood that there was going to be a competition of resources. So there were a lot of very well-established, very well-respected scientists, leaders of the National Conversation on Science. For example, Vannevar Bush, who was the president of MIT, who actually argued strenuously, not just against going to the moon, but against this whole business of sending men into space, that it was a waste of money, it was extremely dangerous, and we had never clearly defined a good reason to do it, other than mm-hmm. the term that was used a lot. Kennedy used it, and all sorts of others used it as well, was prestige, which sounds silly. But at the time, this idea of international prestige
right.
was thought to be crucially important in the Cold War, because you had the nations that were allied with the United States, of course, you had the communist bloc, and then you had a whole range of nations that were sort of in the middle that were often called the uncommitted nations or the undecided nations. And the feeling was that these nations could go either way. They were choosing between two systems. And if the Soviets seemed to have the system that could produce the greatest, most spectacular scientific and technological accomplishments, well, then, you know, maybe that was a reason to align yourself with the power that seemed in possession of the future. And so prestige was a word that had a resonance then that it doesn't quite now, but that's really what it meant. And that didn't wash with everybody. Not everybody thought Prestige was worth the billions and billions of dollars that it was going to cost, that it was already costing just to try to get these guys up into space safely, but that it would certainly cost to get a human being to the surface of the moon and back.
So what point, what date does this sort of get the go-ahead? What date do they finally agree? Is it pre-assassination or post-assassination of JFK?
What's interesting is that it happens very quickly in the wake of Yuri Gagarin's flight. So as I mentioned...
Yeah, but the decision to actually pull the trigger on the moon program, so to speak. Yeah, okay.
Yes, that's right. So there's a period of just a little bit more than a month between... There's actually a period of about exactly a month between the flight of Yuri Gagarin on April 12th and the final decision that Kennedy had been moving toward on May 10th to go ahead and commit to a lunar landing program. He doesn't announce it publicly until he gives his famous speech to Congress of May 25th, when he unveils this idea and makes his argument for it. But he had really reached the decision by the second week in May. So it happens very, very quickly. And it wasn't, even though it happens quickly, it's not a snap decision. He doesn't simply react to Gagarin and say, okay, let's go to the moon. There is an absolute flurry of activity, back and forth, budget meetings, meetings with the Pentagon, meetings with the directors of NASA, engineers. LBJ is running all of this, members of Congress. And he is leading this group, pushing this group toward the decision that he had in fact already made, which was what America had to do, that the entire space program would be oriented toward going to the moon. That would be the focusing mechanism for advancing all of this technology, was setting the goal of reaching the moon.
Well, it seems to me that despite all this work and despite Kennedy naming him head of the program and everything, no one in the 60s, and certainly no one now, has given LBJ the credit he deserves, except as you point out, Walter Cronkite calls him the father of the program after the successful moon landing. Why do you think that label never stuck, at least, or never stuck to LBJ?
Well, this is the fate of vice presidents, is that they tend not...
Yeah, that's true. That's one thing.
They tend not to get credit even for the things that they should be credited with. Johnson really had one moment of seeming to lead the national conversation, national discourse about space, and that was, as I mentioned, in the wake of Sputnik. Not only does Johnson come right out that fall and begin to make speeches, but he actually, after the Soviets succeed in sending up a second Sputnik flight, and this one actually is carrying the passenger of a dog in the fall of 1957, that Johnson declares that essentially this is, in his words, another Pearl Harbor, and he's going to lead hearings in the Senate. So for weeks and weeks toward the end of 1957 to the beginning of 1958, he leads what were called the Johnson hearings and brings a parade of scientists and generals and others in front of him to talk about the fact that the United States was falling dangerously behind. And in January 1958, Johnson and his subcommittee issue a series of recommendations. One of them is to create a civilian space agency, which is NASA, which is what becomes NASA later that year. He's not the only one who ever thought of that idea, but he's really the one who gave it the momentum that it needed and pushed Eisenhower in a position where ultimately he had to embrace it. And NASA was created later in 1958. So that's, for Johnson, that's the high watermark. Johnson's on the cover of Life magazine, questioning somebody aggressively, looking very purposeful, and it's Johnson leading the charge. Then NASA happens, and then there's an election, as we discussed, in 1960. Johnson doesn't get the nomination.
You mean then Sputnik happens?
I'm sorry. I mean, then in the wake of the Johnson hearings, we have the creation of NASA. And then,
I gotcha.
And then we have the advent of Project Mercury at the beginning of 1959, as I talked about a little while ago. And then we're into the election season, and Johnson loses the nomination, as we know, to John Kennedy, and winds up in the second seat. And so the work that he does as chairman of the Space Council, even though he gets a fair amount of attention for it and works very hard to get some attention for it. He makes sure that reporters know that he's the guy who's running the space effort. Most of that work is really happening behind the scenes. And the decision-making process that I described, all those meetings and those memos, all of that, of course, is classified. All of that's happening behind the scenes. So the public doesn't see that it's Johnson that is pushing Kennedy, and that in effect, Kennedy, by this point, is asking Johnson to push him. He's asking Johnson to figure this out and drive this toward some kind of framing of the decision. And so Johnson isn't really understood to be that guy. And then Kennedy steps forward at the podium in the House chamber on May 25th and makes that speech and announces that we're going to the moon. And then it's Kennedy's goal. And Johnson is one of a number of people who work for Kennedy to try to execute toward that goal, to try to move the nation in that direction. Johnson continues to make speeches and to try to work his way into the motorcade every time an American gets into space. And there's Johnson sitting in the car with Alan Shepard and waving his long arm and so forth. But really, by this point, Kennedy owns Kennedy's space program, and Johnson is seen as really a support, an advisor, but in a secondary position. And in fact, he is at this point in a secondary position. He really isn't driving things anymore because he has in a way written himself out of a job. He succeeded in committing NASA and the nation to the lunar goal, and now off they go. And ultimately, there's not that much more for Johnson to do as head of the Space Council. One of the things that he does do is he makes sure that the next big space center is built in his home state of Texas, which is why the Johnson Space Center is located in Houston. That's not a coincidence. But Johnson doesn't have a big role. And after the Kennedy assassination in November 1963, Johnson is seen as inheriting Kennedy's space program and making sure that it all works out okay. It's not seen as his in any way.
Well, and sort of in reality, Kennedy inherited Johnson's initial momentum,
But you know, presidents always make
momentum,
sure that,
if you will, for space.
Presidents are
That's the way. Well, I sometimes feel sorry for LBJ because in a way he's bracketed by Kennedy as the popular notion of the person who started the program. And then Nixon is the president who gets to announce the landing on the moon, gets to, I guess, talk to the astronauts on the moon. And Johnson's sort of in the middle. And I think a wonderful image in your article is when you talk about him, that is LBJ, at the launch of Apollo 11, you know, at Cape Canaveral. But all he is a spectator. And I just think that's an interesting sort of dynamic for someone who's been doing so much work for so long, and yet Kennedy and then later Nixon get sort of all the popular credit anyway.
That's right. And while tragic is probably too strong a word for it, in an era that brought us Vietnam and a series of assassinations, there is something very sad about it. Johnson really did have a stronger claim to leadership of that effort that got Armstrong and Aldrin to the surface of the moon, and of course all of them that followed, really than any other political leader in many ways. I mean, of course, Kennedy ultimately had to make the calls, and Kennedy had to sign the bills, and Kennedy had to make sure that this happened. But in terms of framing the choice and making sure that it ended up the way that it did, that was Lyndon Johnson. But he is bracketed by Kennedy, who declared the goal, and then Nixon, who is in office when the goal is finally achieved. And while a lot of remarkable things were done in space during Johnson's years in office, and you can't get to the moon unless Gemini is a success and unless the early Apollo missions are a success and so forth. Mm-hmm. Those were the years when the public was not particularly interested in the space program. There was a whole lot roiling the country during that period, and space was no longer as exciting as it had been, or as it would be again when Apollo 11 finally got to the moon. And so it really, when the plaque goes up to the moon with the signatures on it, it's bearing Richard Nixon's signature and not Lyndon Johnson's. And there is something very sad about that. And when you watch interviews of Johnson there at Cape Kennedy, as it's called, and he approved the renaming of Cape Canaveral immediately after the assassination. It's hard to know what Lyndon Johnson's really actually feeling, but there is something a little bit wistful or sad about it. And maybe it's just being out of office, but I think it's also recognizing his role in this and recognizing that it's not particularly appreciated.
Well, I think that's one of the main reasons why your article grabbed me so strongly is because on this show, we like to show people that things are usually complicated and there's a lot more than the great man theory of history, even though obviously Johnson is one of these towering figures. You know, there are lots of people involved in this decision and in this work. It isn't just JFK saying, let's do it.
Right, and then all of absolutely. A sudden. Absolutely. And of course, I'm simplifying too. There were a lot of people involved in these decisions, but Johnson orchestrates it. And Johnson knows what he wants the outcome to be. And this was Lyndon Johnson at his most powerful. Lyndon Johnson, as he operated as majority leader in the Senate and in the 1950s, and Johnson as he operated in the first couple of years of his presidency, Johnson, who just understands how to move people toward the goal that he's seeking. And in this case, he's determined to take America to the moon.
Okay, well, there you have it, Buzzkillers. We're going to put a link to the article in the New Yorker on the blog post on our website. And it's just for me to say thank you so much for coming on the show and enlightening us.
Thanks for having me.
This is General George Washington. I never go into battle or start a new country without consulting Professor Buzzkill. Professor Buzzkill is part of Entertainment One's podcast network and is available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and all major podcast apps. Please subscribe and leave him a review. Please also go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com to support him on Patreon, to subscribe to his email notifications, and to shop the Buzzkill bookshelf. Follow him on Facebook, on Twitter at BuzzkillProf, and on Instagram at ProfessorBuzzkill. Thanks for listening.